Okay, so first I wanted to mention one thing that I didn't mention yesterday when I was talking about matrix representations of linear operators. I think I forgot somehow to write the most important relation, which is if I am representing an operator A in some basis AI, then and let's say I call this a matrix. This will be a matrix with components Aij. Then the way to actually find these components is to take a product between two basis vectors with the operator acting on one of them. Or equivalently, this is if you want to use the dual basis vectors, you will have something like this. So this will be very useful when we talk about group representations and algebra representations later on, because these are exactly the kind of things we will be calculating. So let me pass on to that immediately, and let's talk about it. A group representation, so you know that this is a homomorphism from the group to a set of operators. So each group element, let's say G, is mapped to an operator, and let's call this D of G. This is one specific representation, and this must satisfy the properties. It must preserve the multiplication law, right? So G1 and G2 are two elements in the group. Then, yeah.
To represent the matrix components that way, do you need the EI basis to be a multinormal basis?
Let me think about this just for a second. Yes, this would be in an orthonormal basis. Yes, this would be an orthonormal basis. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. I don't think this you can write this in general. No, this should be an orthonormal basis. So the group multiplication law must be preserved in the representation, and the identity element in the group must be mapped to the identity operator, right? So this is the identity operator. And then when we talk about operators, they act on a vector space. And the dimension of the representation is precisely the dimension of the vector space on which these operators act. And if I want to actually calculate the components of these matrices, I need to calculate this scalar product. So this gives us the ij components of this representation. Okay, very good. This will be very useful later. And now, we can start talking about infinite groups. Okay, so I believe one group that you are all familiar with is rotations in three-dimensional Euclidean space. And you know that this is a group because if you perform one rotation and then you make another rotation, maybe around a different axis, you know that you can describe this as one rotation around a third axis. So here we are talking about vectors, let's call them x. And we have, I'm describing Euclidean space just for 1 minute here. So we have vectors x, and we have a scalar product x dot y. And if you want to write this in components, this would be something like the sum over all the components if you write, sorry, let me use a vector here. If the vectors x have components x, y in an orthonormal basis ei, then the usual scalar product is that. And one thing you know is that the metric in Euclidean space is very simple. What is it? It's delta ij. Very good. So this is the Euclidean metric. So in Euclidean space, it happens that the position of the index doesn't actually really matter because xi is exactly the same as xi with index up is exactly the same as xi with index down. That's why I chose to write it here with index up, because it doesn't really matter. But if you want, you know, you might have also seen base notation in terms of, again, column and line vectors. I'm just writing all the notation that you might have seen. Okay, and now what do rotations do here? How would you define a rotation in Euclidean space? A rotation is a transformation that does what? What is a criterion for a rotation? Preserves what?
The norm
of vectors, right? Very good. So rotations are, let's say, linear transformations. So x goes to some x prime, and this would be the operator, r acting on x, that preserve the norm of the vector. And if I require that x prime squared is the same as x squared, this immediately says that the transpose of r times r must be 1. And this is precise the definition of the orthogonal group in three dimensions. So any 3x3 matrix that satisfies this relation is by definition an element of the orthogonal group. Now, let me write this relation, the same relation, in a slightly different way, just because I want to use the metric here. So here I just put indices in this relation. The identity is the same as my metric here because my metric is just a delta. So if this side has indices KL, so must this side. And you can check that I have put the indices almost correctly here. So this relation, you may interpret this as a transformation that preserves the metric in this space, which happens to be just a delta ij here. So you may equivalently say that rotations are the transformations that preserve the Euclidean metric. And the reason I say this is because this generalizes to other groups. So first of all, the first generalization we should do is that ON is the group of transformations that preserve the Euclidean metric in n dimensions. So this is delta ij in n dimensions. In a matrix form, I can write it as 1, 1. This would be n times n zeros everywhere. And then you must have heard of the group SON as well. So the only difference between these two groups is that here we require that the determinant of our operators is actually 1. So already from here, you can see from here, you can see that the determinant of R has to be either plus 1 or minus 1, because we're talking about real matrices now. So if you actually make the choice that the determinant is plus 1, you're talking about the SON group. And now this is the group that that includes the identity in it. So this is the group that includes rotations, but not reflections. Very good. Another generalization is the group SO3,1, which is the Lorentz group. So these are rotations. I'm going to put the rotations in quotation marks here. These are rotations in three plus one dimensional space. So three denotes all the spatial dimensions. And here we also include time as an extra dimension. And these rotations in space and time preserve the Lorentz metric, which we usually write as E time mu nu minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 and 0. So these are the transformations that are relevant to special relativity. And you will be, I think you will study this group in quite a detail with Freddy Cacciazzo in his QFT zero or intro to QFT lectures in 3 weeks from now, because he will explain to you that the way we understand particle physics today is that particles fall under irreducible representations of this group. So I believe that the main purpose of those lectures will be to study representations of this group, so we're not going to do it here. Instead, what we will do here is we will mostly think about the groups UN or SUN. And now we are talking about rotations in complex space. That preserve again the identity. So by definition, UN matrices are n by n complex matrices that satisfy this relation. And for SUN, where n means special, I forgot to say that here, that's the same as S here stands for special orthogonal group. So this is the special unitary group. We also require that the determinant of these matrices is plus one. So we will be interested in representations of these groups mainly. Basically, we will do SU2 in great detail, and then we will see how this can generalize to other groups as well. So let's do one. I want to discuss one more thing about these groups in general, which is how we count the parameters in a group. So let's start with rotations in Euclidean space. So how many parameters does that group have? Louder?
Three.
And can you like give a nice physical reason for that?
Rotation is about three axes.
Exactly. So all the independent rotations you can do are rotations around the three axes. Everything else can be expanded into a product of those rotations. And now let's do a formal counting for this group. So let's start with O3. So we are talking about 3x3 real matrices. So in general, a 3x3 real matrix will have 9 parameters, because it has 9 real entries. But then we have a requirement there. And I'm going to write the indices here, because I think this makes it a little easier. So this is the requirement that an O3 matrix has to satisfy. Now, I don't know if the indices help or not, but anyways, These are, in principle, these are 9 equations again, because the indices A and B can take three values each. But are there really, if these were 9 independent equations, they would actually probably fix all the parameters of the group, and we would only have one possible matrix. But these are not really independent equations, because you can check that these are symmetric equations. So the number of independent equations is the same as the number of independent components of a 3x3 symmetric matrix. So we have 6 independent equations. So if I combine 9 parameters and 6 independent equations, I am left with 3 free parameters. And as somebody already said, these, you can interpret them as rotations around the XYZ or 3 other orthogonal axes. Very good. And SO3, it just imposes that the determinant of R is +1, so you can check that this doesn't really remove another parameter, it just picks only some of those matrices. So again, we have three parameters, but only pick the ones with a positive determinant. Okay, how about U2, those matrices? These are 2x2 complex matrices. So they have 4 complex or 8 real parameters. Very good. And now the constraint we have is U dagger U is equal to 1. You can check that these equations are can be put into a Hermitian matrix. This is because if I take the conjugate of this side, it remains the same. And the same is true for the right-hand side. So we have 4 real equations. And this leaves us with 4 real parameters. Now, what you can see from here is that the determinant of these unitary matrices must be equal to a phase, right, from this equation. Now, the special unitary group requires that the determinant is 1, so it actually fixes this phase. And so this has three real parameters. And one of the things you will be doing in the tutorial today is showing that indeed the most general SU2 matrix can be written as a function of two complex parameters with the extra constraint A squared plus B squared equals 1. So 4 parameters minus 1 constraint, 3 parameters. Oh, I forgot to mention one more group that you might come across. So if you hear about the symplectic group, these are symplectic transformations that leave the symplectic metric invariant. And the symplectic metric in 2n dimension is by definition so this is it is formed of 4 blocks of n by n matrices, and this is just zeros. The identity matrix is here and there, and this is a zero. So again, this is another group. Right. Yeah. Why do I have a plus one in my notes? Can I check this? And I'm confused now. You're probably right.
Start with a minus.
Yeah. Okay. I trust you. Better than my notes. Okay. So. Okay, so let's start with Lie groups now. And by definition, these are groups whose elements depend smoothly on some parameters, and they are smoothly connected to the identity. So depending on the number of independent parameters of the group, we should have here. Yeah, this will be the number of parameters that the Lie group will depend upon. So I'm going to label this AI, and let's say we don't know what A is yet. So each group element can be written as a function of those parameters, and G of 0 is the identity. So let's say for now, I goes from 1 to n. And these are real parameters. That's why we have been counting real parameters everywhere there. Sorry, I should have said, were there any other questions about counting parameters? Is this something that you had seen before? Mostly seen? Yeah.
The fact that two different groups have the same number of parameters kind of indicates that both are isomorphic.
Exactly, it does. They are so. Where did we see the same number of parameters? We saw SO3 and SU2. So you can see that the groups are almost isomorphic. There is this issue there that I said that O3 has three parameters, and then SO3 still has three parameters, but kind of chooses only half of those matrices. That's why the precise statement that you're actually going to check in the tutorial today is that I always get this wrong. So so for every two SU2 matrices, so that would be that SO3 is isomorphic to SU2 over Z2. I think this is correct, because what you will, I always get confused with this, but what you will check in your tutorial today is that you will find a specific map in your tutorial that takes your SU2 matrices into SO3 matrices. And after checking that this map is homomorphic, then you will see that there will always be two SU2 matrices that get mapped to the same SO3 matrix. So two is
two
as you two. Yes. So.
So.
I think.
There is an isomorphism from SU2 to SO3. So no.
No, there is a homomorphism.
There's
a homomorphism.
And then you can, by slashing out component.
Yeah, by. If you want, you can. Yeah, I think this is what this means. This, you will check this today. Actually, this is a bit too early to mention this, but let me say it, that the algebras, which we usually denote by smaller letters, the algebras are actually the same. So when we are studying SU2 representations, we are really studying SO3 representations as well. Just something to keep in mind. Other questions? Yeah.
I'm not sure what that part means. It's the second last line on this board. UAB. So what are A and B?
Exactly. So, okay, sorry. I said this very quickly because you will do this in the tutorial. So I was saying that one thing you will show in the tutorial is that the most general SU2 matrix can be written as a matrix that only depends on two parameters, A and B. These are complex parameters. Sorry, I went through this very quickly. That have to satisfy this extra constraint. And you will see that. So, okay, let me write it. You will see that the most general SU2 matrix can be written like this. This is the precise way in which the two parameters have to go into the matrix. Okay, so let's go back to the definition of a general Lie group, and how about the Lie group representation? if I, so, so of course the same definition is true. This is what we require for a map to be a representation. And now since the group elements depend on those parameters A, we can actually think of the representation matrices also depending on the same set of parameters. And of course we require that D of zero has to be the identity matrix. So this is when all these parameters are zero, because we said when all these parameters are zero, the group element must be the identity in the group, and the identity in the group must be mapped to the identity operator, the identity matrix. So this is what we have. Now, the parameters are continuous, which means that if we stay close enough to the identity, we should always find a group element. So consider say going a tiny bit away from the identity. So let's consider the group element G of delta alpha AI, where all these things are much smaller than one. So this has to be close to the identity. If you do a Taylor expansion, this should be equal to delta AI. So I hope you can still see this, but I'm just doing a Taylor expansion here. And if delta A is so small that that we can forget about all the higher order terms, then this is the really interesting part for us. And this term is what gives us the generators of the group. So by definition, this is equal to 1 plus delta A I here, XI, where these are the generators of the group. Okay, so the generators of the group are operators that take us a little bit away from the identity. Yes.
So that I there, you just stripped off the I from the partial view. That first I is the imaginary unit?
Yes, sorry. This is the imaginary I. Maybe I should have chosen different indices, but this is the imaginary I. It has nothing to do with the index I here. So this is by definition. This is how we define it. So you need to, I'm going to write it now. So if I compare these two expressions, I see that xi must be minus I times this derivative.
So this definition doesn't include these higher order terms, regardless of whether they're small or not?
No, sorry. This definition is no. This refers only to the first orders.
For the higher order terms, you have xi to higher order.
Yeah, you have higher orders, but what we will see, and you will also, part of this you will do in the tutorial, the amazing thing about Lie groups is that actually studying this is enough. And we will see this. Yeah.
There you have D of AI that implies it's the representation of the group element that depends on that particular AI. So I will have for each generator of the Lie group determines me an element of the group.
So we will, very good. Okay, so what we have done so far is go from the group element to a representation and then to a generator, right? But actually what we will see is that you can also go this way. So from the generator, you can find the group element in a specific representation. So let me just write what I said in words before, that by definition, the generators are given by minus I Okay, so here I'm kind of suppressing the index here, but I can put any index and then put I, k. I mean, I just want you to, I evaluated at zero, thank you. I just want you to remember that we don't just have one parameter here, we have many parameters.
So here for defining the generators, the choice of parameter of the parameters, it's arbitrary. I can parameterize my group with different set of parameters, and the generators will still be the same.
So A is a parameter that can take values in R, right? So it's not specified. What we are saying. So for example, when we talk about SU2 and we say it has three real parameters, then those A and Bs can take all possible values with that extra constraint. So you don't really specify the parameters. Were you asking something else?
What if I can take a parameterization of an element of SU2 mm-hmm. and then reparameterize it with another specific parameterization?
Different types of generators.
So the generators can change. So you can choose. So again, we're skipping a bit ahead, but let me write this factor: delta AI XI. You can actually see that these operators form a basis in a vector space. So you can think of changing this basis and redefining these generators. And then the same group element will indeed correspond to a different choice of parameters. But it is the generators that you choose that fix the values of the parameters. Otherwise, the parameters for a specific group element. Otherwise, for a general group element, the parameters can take any value in R.
Necessarily members of the group they generate?
No, they aren't. Because here, so the generators are operators that act on the vector space on which the representation acts. So for example, let's take the group SU2. The matrices, by definition, SU2 matrices act on complex vectors with two entries. Right, so that's the definition of an SU2 matrix. When we talk about a representation, we can build a representation in any dimension. So you can build a 10-dimensional representation of SU2. So you might have 10-dimensional generators. You can they are not the same thing.
But if you're speaking strictly speaking with respect to irreducible Okay, then.
You can, so for SU2, for example, and that's something you will do, you can see that you can build, again, irreducible representations of more or less any dimension. You might have seen the spin 1/2 representation of SU2. We will show that you can actually build spin 1/2, 1/3, and so on representations. And we will do that. Other questions?
Yeah. So you have this homomorphism condition on the representation, right? So
mm-hmm.
making this Taylor expansion should induce some conditions on how the generators
very,
are related, right?
Very good. And this will take us exactly to the algebra. But let me just maybe, should I go there right away? I want to just show you a simpler condition before that, and then we will go, that will take us to the algebra, that requirement. But let me just say, if we are talking about unitary representations, if this representation is unitary, then this means that we require that D of delta AI dagger let me just suppress the index here. Please remember, just so that I don't write an infinite number of indices, always remember that these are many parameters here. So if I expand this equation to first order in delta A, I will get 1 minus I delta A xi dagger times 1 plus So I just took this expression and put it in here. And then to first order in delta AI, you can check that this requires that xi dagger is equal to xi. So when I say to first order, I mean that there was a term delta AI, delta AJ here that I'm just throwing away. So if I'm interested in a unitary representation, the operators have to be Hermitian. And now let's go back to Andres' suggestion, which is let's take the group multiplication law and see what this implies for the generators. So to see this, we need to start thinking about how we are going to represent a general element of the group in terms of the generators, not necessarily an element that is very close to the identity. Well, if you make one step away from the identity and you keep repeating that, let's say infinitely many times, eventually you will go a finite distance away from it. So imagine taking this So if n is very large, then for a finite, this factor here is very small. So this is one small step away from the identity in the direction that this combination specifies. I can repeat this step n times, and I will always be going one step further. And then in the limit that n goes to infinity, this is actually e to the I AI XI. So any group element can be actually written in this form. Okay, so now that we know how to write any group element in this form, let's take two elements. That's right. Yeah. Any representation of the group element can be written in this form.
And here, would we take if we had more than one parameter A, like if we had A
yes.
Nine,
so this is a sum.
Yeah, okay.
So
right.
Iser repeated. This is a sum. Thanks for pointing that out. This is a sum. So everywhere we had, wherever I wrote two I's, they were being repeated.
Notation, then if you look on board number two, the expression for xi
here,
yes, so then that's a d of a k, the derivative of the
yes,
shouldn't that then be I up k down?
Okay, so let me so we have a set of parameters, let's call them a k, where k runs from 1 to whatever the dimension of my representation is. So when I write this, I really mean that this representation is a function of all of the parameters, a1 up to an. So the index, that's why I was avoiding to write it. But here I wanted to write this, that's why I wrote it. So k here takes all possible values. All I'm saying here is that d is a function of all the ak's. And actually you need to calculate that when all, so you need to calculate the derivative and then set all the ak's equal to zero to find the first term in the Taylor expansion. So this is what I mean by this notation, and to avoid confusion, but I didn't quite avoid it, I will be writing this as D of A. Just keep in mind, it's not just one A, it's a set of A's. It's a set of N parameters. Same with B here.
I have a question. When one takes, for example, an element of a Lie group, I can always work in the infinitesimal version of it, and what you just did here is a justification that for finite.
Yeah. So from the infinitesimal, you can actually go to a finite group element.
Right.
This is what we showed here, and now we want to take two finite group elements and multiply them with each other. Okay, so this looks simple, but you know that it is not if xi doesn't commute with xj. If they did commute, you could just write this as the exponential of I times ax plus bx. But unfortunately, this is, well, not unfortunately, because this is all the beauty here, but this is not the case. However, you know that this must be a group element. So this must be some e to the I, let's call this c k xk because of the requirement, because of that requirement.
Sum over the I index,
yes,
the original generator group element or group representation, the sum is in the exponential. Is there some well ordering condition or anything like this where because of the fact that the generators may not commute?
Yeah, very good. So this is the definition of the, this is in the definition of the exponential. So by definition, this will be let me write it just somewhere else so that I can, well, it doesn't matter, I'll write it here. So e to the I AAXI will be by definition this is the definition of the exponential. So you know, things will come in a specific order here. I mean, when you say, for example, we have two generators, A1X1 plus A2X2. This is by definition A1X1, A2X2 times A1X1 plus A2. X2. So there is a well-defined ordering here that must be kept. Okay, so we can't just add the two exponents here, but I bet you have seen these formulas before. There are formulas of how to calculate this if you know the commutators of these two operators. So to first order in these parameters A and B, this actually imposes that, sorry, let me not do a mistake here. So I want A and B times X to second order, actually. And this follows from the fact that e to the a times e to the b is something like e to the a plus b minus a half A, B, and so on. So I've just taken the first two terms out of this expression.
This is the Campbell Baker Hausdorff?
Yes. 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 So another thing you will do in the tutorial, not today though, you will do this on Monday, I think. I think I've put it on that tutorial. You will see that if you also keep the x order in this expansion, this will not impose any further constraints other than the constraint that we are going to impose here on the generators. And this is true for all orders actually in this expansion. So once we impose the constraint here, this is enough so that all the higher orders are immediately satisfied here, and this is remarkable about Lie algebras. Very good, but let's see exactly what comes out of here. So we have a generator here and a generator here and a combination of generators. But we know that the whole thing, since this is a generator, this side must also be a generator. In other words, this commutator here must be some combination of X's. So okay. So what we are saying here is that that bracket over there, which looks like AI BJ commutator XI XJ, and remember A, J are being summed over here. Yeah.
Expand both those exponentials and then just multiply everything out to the second order, like the same way you did, you know, to get the generators to begin with.
Sorry, why I didn't want this to be infinitesimally small? Is this what you're asking?
Yeah.
Or? Yeah. Okay. You're right. So in a sense, what I'm doing here is almost at the one difference here is that I'm keeping second order terms. So if I was doing a strictly infinitesimal expansion, I should say these terms are second order, so they should be thrown out. But as I said, the remarkable thing here is that this holds to all orders, not only to first order. And yeah, we don't have time to go through this here, but you will see it in Monday's tutorial. Okay, so this must be a combination of, oh, let me not call this CK because I've used CK there. So this must be some combination of generators. In other words, this thing here must be a generator. And sorry, actually, let me just be quicker here. This is fine. From here, we see that if this is to be true for all A's and B's, then XIXJ must be some linear combination of generators. And by convention, we thank you.
This K is the same as the K on the left-hand side of the equality.
So all the Ks are being summed over. So this thing means sum over K, sum over I, and sum over J. So here I have a sum over I, sum over J, sum over K here. And K takes no specific value everywhere. So this would be, in principle, this could be anything, but it has to be, but we label this in this way to show that it depends on I and J. Yeah.
I'm having trouble appreciating the difference between saying that that product has to be another generator versus that product just has to be something that a group element maps to. Because you know, since you preserve group multiplication in a representation, it's obvious that that commutator, which is just a linear, like a product of like the representation. So I don't know if that's
but,
yeah.
Okay, sure. I mean, if you think that's trivial, that's fine. But I don't think we're saying anything more than that. We're saying that because this must be a representation, then the commutator between two generators must be another generator. That's all this statement says.
I guess my question is it different than saying like dA times dB equals dC? Is it stronger to say that like the commutator of xi and xj equals xk?
It. So the reason why we want to do this is because every group element, it is already important to say that every group element can be written as an e to the I times some generators, because this is an infinite group, and now we're going down to a finite number of generators. So we're talking about SU2, you have infinitely many SU2 matrices, however, you will have only three generators. And we will see that it is enough to study the vector space that these three generators span to actually understand everything that goes on in the group SU2. So, you know, if you know nothing about what a generator is, maybe there's no reason a priori to say this is more important than the fact that the representation has to preserve the multiplication law. But this turns out to be... We want to actually study the generators, and this is why we're interested in this expression. Yeah? Okay, so whatever this number is, a set of numbers is called the structure constants. So the structure constants Fijk are a collection of, in principle, n times n times n numbers, right? However, already you can see that because the commutator is anti-symmetric, then immediately the structure constants have to be anti-symmetric in I and j. So maybe you have n squared structure constants or something like that. It doesn't matter. But the important thing is they actually, if you know these structure constants, you know everything about the algebra of this group. So this is the Lie algebra. And you know everything about the group. This is because once you know this, you can actually calculate all the higher order terms in this expansion, and thus you can construct any combination of any group element that is another combination of another two elements. So the structure constants, they summarize all the information about group multiplication. So where we had a group with infinite elements and, you know, we just had to multiply two elements to see what we get, actually here, if we know a set of numbers, a finite set of numbers, we actually know all the rules for multiplying elements in this group. The structure constants are really, really important. Where was that unitary? Okay, I will leave this to you as a small exercise because I'm going slower than what I thought. So just check that if the representation is unitary, then the structure constants have to be real. So this is a useful statement. We will be using this. Just try to prove this. It's simple. And okay, we can do this on Monday. But okay, in the remaining 5 minutes, let's just talk a little bit about algebras in general. So I said that this commutation relation is a Lie algebra. So perhaps you've already looked at it in the set of notes that I gave you. There is the formal definition of an algebra. So you may want to check that this is a well-defined algebra indeed. And then
this question. So when we began with the Lie group representation that gave rise to the generators of the Lie group, which satisfied the commutation relations of the Lie algebra. So my question is, a Lie group representation induces a Lie algebra representation so that these generators are in a particular representation?
Okay, so you can start with a representation, and to give you an example for SU2, for example, we will start with the defining representation, which is the definition of SU2. We will find the generators. We will find the precise algebra they have to satisfy, and then we will start from there. And then we can build representations of the algebra itself. So actually, our next step will be to see what kind of representations of the generators we can build. So I would say the two steps are kind of separate. You can actually, more or less, on Monday when we talk about the algebra, maybe we will forget that we know anything about the group, and we will just start with an algebra and study its representations.
So is there any relation between the representations of the algebra and the representations of the group? Because sometimes I guess it would be easier to find representations of the algebra than representations from the group, right?
Yeah, indeed. So once you know a representation of the algebra, then you can exponentiate that and find the representation of the group. Right? So any group element in that representation will be given by the exponential of some sum of generators. So, okay, this is too late to start with algebras now, but I was going to talk about, forget a little bit about Lie algebras and just give you some examples of other algebras. So please at least read what is in the notes, just so that you, I'm not sure if you have seen algebras before. See why the C numbers form an algebra. What I had in my notes was mainly Clifford algebras. So, you know, maybe you can tell me later today in the tutorial, for example, if this is something you would be interested in hearing about, and I can see whether I can fit it in somewhere. Okay. If there are no more questions, I'll see you at 3:30. Thank you.